Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
The Global Jigsaw is the podcast zooming in on the world's political, security and social shifts through the lens of its media.
A complete lack of control of the state and the government.
Conflicting narratives.
They're feeling the impact of this war.
The Global Jigsaw from the BBC World Service.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson, and in the early hours of Thursday, the 4th of April, these are our main stories. After the deaths of aid agency workers in an Israeli military strike in Gaza, is this a turning point for Israel's allies? More than 100 people are missing in road tunnels and quarries following a powerful earthquake in Taiwan. We hear from the worst affected area.
Even as I'm standing here, we can feel every now and again the ground begin to move beneath us. The buildings begin to shake slightly. There are aftershocks. So there is a concern that there could be continued damage.
NATO looks at ways to provide long-term military support for Ukraine's fight against Russia in the absence of billions of stalled funds from the US. Also in this podcast, questions over trophy hunting come to the fore yet again.
These import bans that have been discussed by Germany and other Western countries are largely misguided because trophy hunting is not a threat to a single species.
And why dead politicians are appearing on the campaign trail for India's upcoming general election. The government in Jerusalem has now acknowledged the killing of 7 aid workers in Israeli airstrikes in Gaza was a tragic error. A spokesman said an investigation found they'd been targeted because of what he called misidentification. The founder of World Central Kitchen, the chef Jose Andres, has accused Israeli forces of deliberately targeting the aid organization's vehicles. 6 of the aid workers were international, 3 of whom were British. The UK's Foreign Secretary David Cameron said Israel had to ensure the safety of aid workers and that enough aid is getting into Gaza.
I welcome what the Israeli foreign minister said yesterday to me about a full, urgent and transparent inquiry into how this dreadful event was allowed to happen. And we want to see that happen very, very quickly. I also welcome the fact that he spoke about much more aid getting into Gaza, up to 500 trucks a day. That is essential. But of course, the extra aid won't work unless there is proper deconfliction, unless aid can be taken around Gaza and we avoid the dreadful incidents like we've seen in the last couple of days. That is vital, and Britain will be watching very closely to make sure that that happens.
There are fears that Israel is making it almost impossible for the aid agencies to operate in Gaza, and more agencies could be forced to pull out. World Central Kitchen has already done that. Our correspondent Hugo Bachega reports from Jerusalem.
In a rare admission of fault, Israel's military said the initial findings of an investigation suggested the strike had been a mistake carried out after a misidentification. Avi Haiman is a spokesman for the Israeli government.
There is an investigation which will be made public and will come out in the coming days. Preliminary findings show that it was a tragic, tragic mistake, and my heart goes out to the families involved, to the families of the victims. What I'll say is that it has happened in the past that Hamas and other terrorist organizations have used ambulances to transport their people.
We still don't have official details about the misidentification or how the strike was approved to go ahead. The convoy hit was clearly marked with the World Central Kitchen logo, and its movements had been coordinated with the Israeli military, precisely to prevent something like what happened. Israel was already facing growing international anger over a conflict that's killed nearly 33,000 Palestinians, according to the Hamas Health Ministry. Charities and some of Israel's key partners have accused the country of not doing enough to protect civilians and of intentionally slowing down the entry and delivery of basic supplies, weaponizing aid, claims Israel denies. Nate Mook is the former head of World Central Kitchen.
famine was already declared or nearly declared in northern Gaza by the United Nations. The United Nations, the World Food Program, has been unable to access these areas. This is a tragedy, you know, not just for the aid community, not just for the families of those we've lost, but, you know, this is a tragedy for the people of Gaza and really for the world.
This incident has highlighted the difficult circumstances in which humanitarian workers are having to operate in Gaza. Israel has now promised to improve coordination with those groups. But the strong condemnation from some of its closest allies is an indication that patience could be running out.
In Israel, there's increasing pressure on the Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu. Since the strike, Mr. Netanyahu's closest allies in the West have been united in their vocal criticism. So, diplomatically, could this be a turning point in Israel's relations with its allies? Here's our security correspondent, Frank Gardner.
Israel is more isolated than ever before. Its closest allies, Britain and the US, are unanimous in condemning it. Very strong words from the White House talking about outrage. Condemnation from the UN Secretary General, Antonio Guterres. In Britain, for the first time in 12 years, you've got the Israeli ambassador being summoned to the Foreign Office for a dressing down. Is this actually going to change the conduct of the course of the war? Well, that's up to the Israelis. The only thing that would change it in terms of US action is if they cut off the supply of arms, and that doesn't look like it's going to happen. But there are increasing calls for Britain to review whether or not Israel is breaking the law of armed conflict, the rules of war. If it is, then Britain would itself be breaking its own rules by supplying components to things like drones and F-35s, which are manufactured in the UK. There are two big effects to what's happened here. One is diplomatic, and of course the second is humanitarian. It's not only a tragedy to the seven people who lost their lives, plus the rest of the 196 humanitarian aid workers and all the 32,000 Palestinians, but all that aid that had arrived by ship has gone back to Cyprus. So apart from the 100 tonnes that was offloaded, all the rest has had to go back because World Central Kitchen, they were the ones who were actually getting this stuff ashore, and now they've had to suspend operations. So it's a tragedy on many levels.
Frank Gardner. Now let's return to another story we covered in our earlier Global News podcast, the magnitude 7.4 earthquake which hit Taiwan's eastern coast early on Wednesday morning. So far, at least 9 people are confirmed dead and more than 1,000 have been injured. The focus now is on rescuing those who are trapped following the largest quake to hit Taiwan in decades. The strength of the tremors took many Taiwanese by surprise, like this young filmmaker.
I was making my coffee when everything starts shaking and rattling. It was really, really scary. I was holding on to my bookcase, trying to steady myself because everything else was falling off my glassware and plate. And I could hear people screaming, you know, inside my head. It was like, what to do, what to do?
I got more from reporter Jan Kamenzind-Brumby, who's in Hualien City, the epicentre of the quake.
The search in Hualien is ongoing for people who are trapped here as a result of this earthquake, the largest earthquake in the last 25 years that Taiwan has seen. A lot of people affected, especially in Hualien City and in Hualien County. I'm standing looking at a large building that slumped over, and was speaking earlier to an engineer who was saying that they had been undergoing a large effort to try and rescue the last people who had been trapped in there. That last person now has been thankfully saved and is undergoing treatment in a local hospital. Not everyone was so lucky. However, we spoke to one person who was standing outside of the ruined walls of his own house that had been destroyed by the earthquake. He said that one of the people who used to frequent his bar had passed away. They lived in that building that had slumped down in Hualien. There are lots of people also, we think, still trapped in the mountains around Hualien. It's a very touristy place. It's known for its mountains. People take their time cycling and driving up through the mountain passes, through tunnels. And lots of those tunnels have become obstructed as a result of the large landslides that we saw earlier today because of this earthquake and the aftershocks that have followed.
Describe more to us about how the landscape and the infrastructure has been affected.
Well, I will say one thing. Taiwan has done a considerably better job this time than it did 25 years ago. the rules, regulations, and the infrastructure changes that were put in place after that deadly earthquake that left thousands dead in 1999 have clearly had some kind of an impact. In Hualien, where I'm standing, we spoke to a local county official who said that there are 18 large buildings that have undergone significant serious damage. But 18 pales in comparison to the number that we saw in 1999, the last time we had an earthquake that was this size. One issue, though, people here are supposed to get earthquake warnings on their phones when there are significant earthquakes. That was one of the warning systems that was put in place. That didn't happen. And there are some people asking why, when there was an earthquake this size, they weren't warned about it earlier.
And is there a lot of concern that more tremors might be on the way?
Well, the Japanese Meteorological Agency earlier today said that we can expect more tremors. Even as I'm standing here, we can feel every now and again the ground begin to move beneath us. The buildings begin to shake slightly. There are aftershocks. These are common often when you have large earthquakes. So there is a concern that there could be continued damage. But that being said, the military has been drafted in to help here. The firefighters are working in full force to demolish buildings that look unsafe and to ensure that no further people get injured.
Jan Kamenzin-Brumby in Taiwan. NATO foreign ministers have been discussing plans to provide long-term military support for Ukraine to continue its fight with invading Russian forces. The Secretary General, Jens Stoltenberg, said no decisions had yet been taken, but the military alliance had started planning a greater role in providing finance, training and security for Kyiv. A massive $60 billion of proposed additional funding for Ukraine in the US remains blocked in Congress by Republicans. From Brussels, here's our defence correspondent, Jonathan Beale.
Jens Stoltenberg said Ukraine needed urgent help, and delays in providing military support were already having consequences on the battlefield. Russia's pressing its current advantage of greater manpower and supplies of ammunition. NATO's Secretary General is not just worried about the present, but also the longer term. He's put forward proposals to secure military support for Kyiv for the next 5 years, what some have called a Trump-proof plan, should he be elected president for a second term. It includes a goal of creating a 100 billion euro defence package for Ukraine and NATO taking over the US-led contact group which coordinates military support. Mr. Stoltenberg said NATO was in it for the long haul.
The Ukrainians are not running out of courage. They are running out of ammunition. We need to step up now and ensure our support is built to last. So in our meeting today, we discussed how to put our support on a firmer and more enduring basis for the future. All allies agree on the need to support Ukraine in this critical moment.
Tomorrow, foreign ministers will attend a ceremony marking the 75th anniversary of the creation of NATO. The alliance has steadily grown from a dozen to 32 members, but still not all meet its target of spending 2% of their national income on defence. The UK has said that should be the goal for all members to mark this milestone.
Jonathan Beale. In Haiti, where armed gangs have inflicted chaos and unimaginable brutality on everyday life in the capital and beyond, a state of emergency was officially due to end on Wednesday. But widespread violence persists. Armed gunmen are currently threatening to take control of the country's biggest hospital. Tens of thousands of people have fled Port-au-Prince, including aid worker Matt Knight from the humanitarian group GOAL. That role has taken him to some of the most dangerous places in the world. And speaking from Cap Haitien, Paul Henley asked how his experience in Haiti compared to them.
This one was really difficult, I think, because of the randomness. You just can't predict where it's going to spring up next, and you don't know who's going to spring up. So when I worked in Ukraine, it was a very obvious enemy. You knew that when the air raid sirens went off, you had to get down into the air raid shelters. Here, it can happen anytime, any day, and the different gangs don't wear different uniforms, so you don't know who is a member of a gang and who's not a member of a gang.
What are you waiting for to get back into Port-au-Prince to continue your aid work?
Goal have still got 79 Haitian nationals who will continue to deliver aid, even though I'm not there. And ironically, the area that we work in predominantly is called Carrefour. Normally, that would be a relatively dangerous area for our staff to work in. But because the fighting has moved up into Pétionville, into different areas of Port-au-Prince, it has actually meant that it's been safer for us to get our staff into other areas of the capital.
Is there any sign that the much-anticipated transitional council in Haiti will be put in place and the situation will change?
No, actually, if anything, that's made things more difficult. So yesterday there were demonstrations organised both in the capital and in Jeremy, which is another area that Gol work in the regions. Demonstrations were organised because people don't feel like the gangs have got a voice in the transitional council, and the transitional council doesn't actually represent the people. So I think in the short term, we're likely to see more trouble rather than less because of the arrangements of the transitional council.
Matt Knight in Haiti. The divisive and emotive issue of trophy hunting in Africa has come to the fore yet again, after the Environment Ministry in Berlin said it was considering tighter restrictions on the import of hunting trophies. The president of Botswana responded on Tuesday by threatening to send 20,000 elephants to Germany. Meanwhile, the South African government says it'll phase out breeding captive lions for hunting. Our Africa regional editor, Richard Hamilton, told me more about the different approaches of the two countries.
South Africa seems to be agreeing with the sensitivities of Western countries and animal rights groups, which are against trophy hunting because they say it's cruel, barbaric and outmoded. And South Africa wants to phase it out for lions. But on the other hand, Botswana represents the other side of the argument. They say that trophy hunting is a vital part of conservation. It helps fund conservation and it helps control the elephant population, which is 130,000 in Botswana. And that's why the president rather rhetorically threatened to send 20,000 to Germany. But basically, that was in response, as you say, to Germany threatening to tighten the rules. But it's a nuanced subject and it's not just a one-way argument. And Dan Challender is a conservation scientist from Oxford University here in Britain.
Botswana's ranked first in the world for conserving megafauna, including African elephants. So it's got a really successful conservation model, and that happens to include trophy hunting. These import bans that have been discussed by Germany and a range of other Western countries are largely misguided, because trophy hunting is not a threat to a single species. And so this idea that these import bans would help protect threatened or endangered species is essentially unfounded.
This is big business, isn't it, in both countries? It's making a lot of people a lot of money, isn't it, Richard?
That's right. And South Africa has depended on trophy hunting. It's estimated that every year trophy hunters have been spending around $250 million and contributing about $340 million to the economy. They also create 17,000 jobs. It's estimated that up to 12,000 lions are kept in captivity in 350 farms in South Africa. And then in Botswana, for elephants, it contributes about $5 million a year. And each hunter would pay about $50,000 for an elephant shoot.
So is there any way through this? Is the international community just at odds with African nations over this issue?
It is a bit, to be honest. The game changer was, the audience may remember, in 2015, a famous lion was killed in Zimbabwe called Cecil. There were images of an American dentist that paraded the dead lion in front of him, and that caused a general outrage amongst Western countries, and that prompted a ban in Zimbabwe and, as you say, South Africa going along with a ban. But there is resentment, perhaps, in African countries that they're being dictated to as to what they should do. So, for example, Zimbabwe wanted to sell its stockpot of ivory, but that's up against Western objections that don't want to encourage poaching. So it's a rather complicated issue and it's quite nuanced. But trophy hunting's become a bit of a diplomatic issue, a bit of a political football.
Richard Hamilton. Still to come on the Global News podcast.
In 2022, they were virtually nothing. And now Temu is getting on for tens of millions of downloads a month.
Has Amazon met its match in the shape of China's Temu? Let's return once again to our main story. The founder of World Central Kitchen, Jose Andres, has said Israeli forces in Gaza systematically targeted the cars carrying seven of his aid workers who were killed on Monday. He also said his charity had clear communication with the Israeli military, which knew the movements of his staff. The UN's humanitarian coordinator, Jamie McGoldrick, told the BBC that Israel's system for allowing aid into Gaza is far too complicated. Shimon Friedman is a spokesman for COGAT, the Israeli government agency responsible for coordinating aid deliveries into Gaza. And he spoke to James Menendez.
COGAT, or the Coordination of Government Activities in the Territories, during the war, we have led and implemented Israel's humanitarian initiatives within the Gaza Strip. And as part of that, we have established a team that is dedicated since day one of the war to understanding this humanitarian situation on the ground. They build their assessment based on conversations that they have with the different international organizations, people that we speak to on the ground, to understand, to facilitate humanitarian aid to the civilians in Gaza. And that means facilitating the entry of humanitarian aid or on trucks, but also facilitating the establishment of field hospitals, for example. And let me say right off the top that what happened with the WCK was a tragedy, and it was a grave mistake. Israel and COGAT express our deepest sorrow for what took place.
How could it have happened, though, given that you do have those detailed conversations?
It was a mistake that followed a misidentification, but we've set up independent professional expert body to investigate it so that we can understand exactly what happened.
But just to explain to our listeners, do you act as a liaison between those aid organisations and the Israeli military when it comes to details of aid deliveries?
We work together with the forces on the ground and with the international organisations, and we coordinate these convoys.
So is it fair to say, and I understand that an investigation is going on, but in broad terms, something went wrong in passing along the information about where this convoy was to the Israeli military, if indeed, as the Israeli government has said, there was an element of misidentification, I think the word was, that was used?
To the best of my knowledge, there wasn't a problem in terms of the information that was passed on. There was, however, as I said, a mistake of misidentification, and that is being looked into right now by the investigation team.
Is there a systemic problem about how this system operates and how your department operates? We spoke to the UN humanitarian coordinator yesterday, who said there were too many layers for notification. In other words, the chances of a miscommunication happening were raised by the fact that information had to be passed to too many people and it wasn't always acted upon.
No, I don't think that there is a systemic problem. And I think that is evident from the fact that there are dozens of coordinations a day and hundreds or thousands of coordinations that have happened since the beginning of the war. What happened was an absolute tragedy, but I do not believe that there is a systemic problem as you described it.
Well, there have been lots of deliveries since the war began, but there also have been a record number of humanitarian workers killed during the Gaza conflict.
I can tell you that we work very closely with the international organizations and with the different agencies in order to coordinate these movements. And it's important to understand that these convoys are coordinated with us in order to make sure that humanitarian aid is getting to whoever needs it.
The other thing that the humanitarian coordinator told us, Jamie McGoldrick, said that it would be much preferable for organisations to talk to the Israeli military directly and not go through your agency.
The coordination of this operation is something that COGAT has been doing since the beginning of the war. We have officers on the ground within the forces in order to facilitate and make sure that coordination is done correctly. And we'll continue to work with them closely. And if we learn from this investigation that there are steps that need to be taken, we will, of course, take them.
Shimon Friedman speaking to James Menendez. The former president of the Spanish Football Federation, Luis Rubiales, has been arrested in a corruption investigation. He was detained after stepping off a plane and is suspected of receiving illegal commissions when negotiating deals over the Spanish Super Cup competition. Such deals can be worth around $45 million. Mr. Rubiales has denied any wrongdoing. Our correspondent Guy Hedgeco in Madrid explains.
Investigators believe that Luis Rubiales may have received these illegal commissions while he was negotiating these contracts to stage the Spanish Super Cup football competition in Saudi Arabia. The competition has been held in Saudi Arabia on a number of occasions over the last few years. These contracts are extremely lucrative, and the investigators believe that he may have personally benefited from them and illegally so. So these are very serious allegations against him. He denies any wrongdoing. However, separately from that, he is also due to go on trial for sexual assault. And that's because of the kiss that he gave Yeni Hermoso, the Spanish player, at the end of the Women's World Cup final last August.
Guy Hedgeco in Madrid. The French Parliament has held its first ever debate based on Britain's Prime Minister's questions, a weekly half-an-hour session in which the leader of the government is grilled by parliamentarians. The event is renowned for its rowdiness and the cut and thrust of debate, in which political fortunes have been known to rise and to fall. Here's a flavour.
Shut up a minute! To the Honourable Gentleman, I will not tolerate such behaviour.
In Paris, it was French Prime Minister Gabriel Attal who took questions from MPs. So did it descend into scenes of chaos? Our correspondent in Paris, Hugh Schofield, was watching.
Bonjour à tous. La séance est ouverte.
It was all the idea of the National Assembly's Speaker, Yael Braun-Pivet, who thought the existing questions to the government were too boring, and knowing a little of the Westminster model, decided to create an experimental French QPM, or Question au Premier Ministre.
Merci, Madame la Présidente.
As it happened, the Prime Minister, the very presentable Gabriel Attal, was more than happy to go along because, a bit like his boss, President Macron, he prides himself on his debating skills and his ability to out-argue the most persistent of adversaries.
Les élèves puissent changer de groupe.
He certainly put on an accomplished show, here defending the government's introduction of streaming based on ability in schools, and in something of an echo from across the channel, turning on hecklers from the far-left LFI party.
C'est pas la peine d'essayer de hurler.
There's no point in shouting to get me to stop, he said. It doesn't work. The Assembly was certainly a bit fuller and a bit noisier than usual, but the truth is these are two houses with such different traditions that trying to make the one more like the other is futile. French parliamentary rhetoric is in general scripted, monotone, and totally lacking in the improvisational wit that can make PMQs such fun to watch. Perhaps it's only fair to say also that what happens less often resembles a bun fight.
Hugh Schofield in Paris. Next to India, where parties in the southern state of Tamil Nadu have found a novel way of campaigning for the general election later this month. They're using so-called ghost appearances or deep fakes of dead political figures, as Lipika Pelham reports.
Vanakkam, naan ungal Jay Jayalalitha pesugiren.
This AI-generated voice clip is saying, "Hello, I am your Jayalalitha speaking." Then the actress turned politician who died in 2016 urges her voters to bring back the people's government of her party that ruled Tamil Nadu from 1991 for 14 years. In an AI-generated video, her arch-rival, another late former leader, M. Karunanidhi, appeared in his trademark yellow scarf and black sunglasses, showering praise on his son, M.K. Stalin, the current chief minister. Karunanidhi died in 2018. The resurrection of charismatic speakers offers cost-effective campaigning, but critics warn such tools are a threat to democracy.
Lipika Pelham. The Chinese-owned online shopping platform Temu has exploded in popularity in the past year, shipping to customers in 49 countries around the world. It sells everything from clothes to electronics at extremely low prices and even advertised during this year's Super Bowl. The BBC's Sam Gruey has been investigating how it is so cheap and how it can afford to spend millions of dollars on advertising.
The 49ers are going back to the Super Bowl.
A record 123 million Americans tuned into the Super Bowl last month. They were there for the nation's biggest sporting event and a dazzling halftime performance. But they got something else too.
I feel like a billionaire. I'm shopping like a billionaire.
Six 30-second commercials for a Chinese-owned online shopping platform that's transforming the world of online e-commerce, Temu. It launched in the US in 2022 and is the offspring of Pinduoduo, which dominates China's home market.
Every Chinese person is buying their products, whether it be a speaker or a t-shirt or socks.
Sean Ren is the founder of the China Market Research Group. He says there's a reason Temu's prices are so low.
They're mostly selling unbranded goods. You're able to go straight to the consumer, straight from the factories, which is why they're able to have such cheap prices.
It's a bit like Amazon on steroids.
That's retail analyst Neil Saunders.
When you open the app or you go to the site, there's lots of products flashing up at you, lots of discounts, lots of offers. In 2022, they were virtually nothing. And now Temu is getting on for tens of millions of downloads a month.
A big reason for this? Advertising.
The company shelled out $7 million to run 30-second commercials during the Super Bowl.
That and we know that after that commercial, Temu downloads really spiked in the US.
Cheap products must be good for the consumer, right? Well, some people have raised concerns about Temu's supply chains, including Alicia Kearns, a British politician for the Conservative Party.
So when you look into where Temu gets its goods from, where in China it is producing them, you can see that these are areas where we know that there is the use of forced Uyghur slave labour.
She's talking about the Uyghur people.
It's estimated that nearly a million mostly Muslim Uyghurs are detained in camps in the northwest region of Xinjiang. China denies the claims and says the camps are vocational training schools.
A report from last year from the US Select Committee on the Chinese Communist Party found there was an extremely high risk Temu products could have been made using forced labour, as the company only requires suppliers to agree to a code of conduct. Temu says it strictly prohibits the use of forced, penal or child labour by all of its merchants. But with prices so low, some people feel they don't have a choice about shopping at Temu, like single mum Rina, who lives in the UK.
Sometimes I feel guilty, you know, because I know this fast fashion. Unfortunately, at this time, I cannot go to more sustainable shops.
US consumers do seem to be buying into Temu. It was Apple's most downloaded free app in 2023 and currently has more than 100 million active users. Temu now wants to take on its China-owned retail rival Shein and ultimately Amazon. But with politicians viewing Chinese-owned companies with growing hostility, that might not be so easy.
Sam Gruey reporting. And that's it from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Chris Hansen. The producer was Emma Joseph. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Until next time, bye-bye.